Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. You're listening to us. You can reach us with your calls or via email, 410-662-8780. Or the email address is foremanwolf@wypr.org. And now the government shutdown seems like it's over, so we should be talking about American food.
I think we should. I think it's... We have a tremendous history here in our country of cooking, and it's fascinating, quite frankly.
One is particular. I mean, there are a lot of different melting pot cuisines around the world, but I guess necessarily, I mean, we should take pride in the fact that ours is maybe the broadest, because
definitely.
It's coming from all directions.
Yeah, I was looking. Someone gave me this absolutely amazing book that has menus starting with 1850. All American menus, and it's laid out so you can see these old menus, and has a little bit of history and story in the book as well. And it's really fascinating to me to see, you know, that sometimes it will say a la Mexican, or you can see the Indian influences with curries and things. And obviously, you know, it was so special and thought of as being exotic. And you know, it when you think about it, those were really, you know, you had Native Americans, that the culture was very similar and the food style was very similar to the Mexican culture. It's kind of ironic that that was considered to be exotic when that really is part of the roots of our cooking.
Well, I mean, there are so many roots. That's it's not just, you know, English expats.
Right.
Doing the cooking. I mean, but as you go around different regions of the country, you find all kinds of different melting pots. If you recall, when I was doing research one time about West Coast food, and the melting pot there is so different. It's, you know, there's so much the Pacific Rim, Asian culture food, Polynesian influences on the food, lots and lots of Latin food, and Italian immigrants that came from the East Coast. I mean, it's a totally different thing from what you find in New Jersey or in Boston or in
many miles
South
away.
Carolina.
Well, when you have a culture that where, you know, if you think of the East Coast being settled in the 1600s, and you know that whole influence can't really affect the West Coast that much, because it's just they couldn't travel from the east to the west that easily. So not like obviously we can hop in an airplane. So, you know, you're talking about things that ended up, while they had their influences from the other ethnic backgrounds, you also at the same time sort of had a pristine culture and a pristine food, because of the fact that you had to use what was right there, because you couldn't have something flown in, obviously, in the 1600s.
Strangely enough, working farm to table long before it became a popular movement.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So what I'm curious about, and what I love to hear from callers about, are some of their sort of hero American chefs, or the people that kind of turned them on to cooking that was not, I mean, we talk awfully often about Eurocentric, that's a terrible phrase, awfully often, about a Eurocentric food. We both have excitement for that. But things that are very homegrown, or the redo of some older idea of American food, who are the people that did that, that, you know, when you were, like, for you as a young cook, long before you were a chef, who, you know, what figure did you run into that was inspirational, that was actually, you know, a homegrown American chef?
I think the for me, to answer the question, and ironically, I was just in Los Angeles over the past weekend, and I specifically ate at Wolfgang Puck's restaurant, because I have always admired him as a chef and as a business owner. And he opened Spago in 1982, which is a year that I graduated from high school. So Spago was starting to do really, really well, right? And I started cooking 2 years later professionally, or a year and a half later, because I only went to college for a year, left school, and came home to where my parents were now living, which was Charleston, South Carolina. And I mean, you could really feel Wolfgang Puck's influence at that time on cooking in the United States, and Alice Waters, And the two, I can't think of their names, but the two ladies that did the Silver Palette, oh my gosh, remember how like everybody was reading that cookbook, the Silver Palette? I feel like that, I can't believe I don't even know their names off the top of my head, but I believe that those ladies really also had a big influence. And I even remember my sous chef where I was
California was definitely well ahead of the East Coast in saying, we're doing our own food. And whether it was Alice Waters in Berkeley, who was an American, or Wolfgang Puck, who was an immigrant from Austria, mm-hmm. who had been trained classically, but who got here and kind of blew it up. Mm-hmm. You know, you have two people, Northern and Southern California, who definitely made a huge
big impact. And she, of course, will always, because she's so caring about food.
I think one of the reasons that she was so influential is because Jeremiah, one of the big books.
Yeah, Jeremiah
was
Tower.
The one Jeremiah Tower had a book mm-hmm. Called Stars, same as the name of his restaurant in San Francisco. And that was the biggest deal.
Sure was.
When I was like second year in hotel school or something. That was huge. And that a lot of those photographs set a lot of the food style.
Definitely.
It seemed like a lot of the thinking and a lot, you know, just. It's crazy to watch things pattern themselves. I don't know that restaurant was incredibly successful. You know, there were a couple of restaurants that were, Fleur-de-Lis is another one, same time mm-hmm. and into the 90s that Hubert Keller had.
Yeah.
That was, I don't know that it was incredibly successful, but again, there was a book and there was a whole like movement and bunch of ideas that.
Well, that greatly influenced what was happening.
Yeah.
There's no question. Well, and honestly, also, Jean-Louis Baladin was also a huge influence at that time as well, because he came from France as a Michelin-starred chef, a very, very talented chef.
Was he doing
chef.
American food, or was he doing French food in America?
My point is not that he was doing American food. My point is that he affected what was going on with American cooking, because he demanded great products. And that was really his influence on American cooking, because all of a sudden, you know, when I've said this a couple of times, when I first started cooking, we didn't even use shallots. They weren't around. You know, and of course, a French chef has to have shallots. You know, a French chef needs chanterelle mushrooms, you know, all these things that they're so used to working with. So he found people to forage for him. He found, you know, a fisherman to get the fish that he wanted.
Pretty crazy. If you recall, I worked on an opening of a restaurant in Atlanta that mm-hmm. he was partners in. Mm-hmm. And he would call me and say, I'm having a fish scent, or I'm having berries scent. And we'd get, and this is 1992, we'd get four crates of fresh berries from California, and their shipping bill, they were like $600.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, my gosh. That hurts your feeling as a chef, doesn't it?
Yes, it hurts my feelings a lot, because that's outrageous. Oh, my God.
And we would get, you know, you'd get an entire swordfish.
An entire swordfish?
An entire, not just a wheel, ooh, an entire swordfish.
Wow, you better serve a
lot of
people.
We didn't have that many seats.
You didn't have that
if
many guests either.
If everyone ate swordfish, we had too much swordfish.
Yeah, that restaurant went out of business. Yeah.
Yes, it did.
Yeah. Well, he was a great chef, and he definitely, you know, was, along with Alice Waters, well, those two people, I feel like, were just extremely important as far as product-driven people, you know, along with their thought process and their philosophy as chefs.
That orientation, yeah. The people you're thinking of are Julie Rosso and Sheila Lukens,
oh, good.
Who
okay.
wrote The
From
Silver,
Silver
Palette.
Palette. Yeah,
yeah. Our research department came up with
thank
that
you.
information.
Top
with,
notch.
With a whiz bang.
Oh, my gosh.
But it there was a time, it seemed like in the 70s, all of a sudden, 70s, 80s, things changed. It wasn't just Europeans who moved here that were teaching us to cook.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And it wasn't
after
just
World War II.
You know, it was someone, if it was a European that was changing, and it was American food from the inside out, it was someone like Wolfgang Puck mm-hmm. who came here, who knew how to cook, who had learned how to cook, but who wanted to forget everything about that he'd been doing and do new things.
Yeah, he worked at the hotel.
And draw from different cultures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he worked at the Hotel Paris in Monaco. I mean, he worked at a couple of the best restaurants in France.
Another guy that did a lot style-wise, if you recall, in the early 90s, yeah, so probably 1990 and after that, Alfred Portale at the Gotham
yes.
Bar and Grill.
Yes.
Everyone plated food like this guy.
Yes. That was a huge influence on plating style. That's when everything became high. All the food was a tower of food, you know. It was, That's, oh my gosh, his food was so good too. We went to the Beard House
a couple
of times. We had a
number of excellent meals there.
Yeah, we took staff there, yeah, a good amount of times, and that, I loved his food. He was very influential on cooking for that time. You said the 90s, right?
From about 1990 on.
Into the 2000s, yeah.
If you want to give us a ring, 410-662-8780. If you have any American chef heroes that you want to talk about, a particular dish that was a big favorite at a place that you can't let go of the memory of, or email us formanwolf@wipr.org. Or if you gigantically disagree with us, please come on and
I think, and
straighten Cindy out.
Oh, good. Please straighten me out. So one of the other people is Edna Lewis, who was just incredibly important from the preservation of the pathways of Southern cooking. I mean, if we didn't have Edna Lewis, a lot of things wouldn't have been documented. And
There are a couple of pieces of American cooking that did not get celebrated too much until you got to into the 90s.
Right. Well,
and Southern cooking being one of those things. I guess besides the Louisiana Kitchen and Paul Prudhomme.
Yeah. Paul, and Paul's influence was much more in the 70s and the 80s, too. I mean, of course, it carried on throughout his entire life. But when I did my apprenticeship, it's interesting. I'm so thankful for the time that I was born because of the timing of the beginning of my really starting to cook was an interesting time as you were also starting your work. And I think that whole thing with finally recognizing Southern cooking as one of our more important parts of our culinary history and having Paul Prudhomme become famous and recognized and Blackened Fish and Shrimp Diane and all these dishes that he became famous for making, really his cookbook is his work, his dedication to his craft and his family history and all of that, and the fact that he documented it by doing a very good cookbook is extremely important. And Edna Lewis did the same thing with her cookbooks. You know, The Pursuit of Flavor is by Edna Lewis is one of my favorite cookbooks ever. And when you and I opened Georgia Brown in Washington, D.C., really that book was very instrumental in helping me to figure out what I needed to do on that opening menu there to really do true Southern cooking, authentic Southern cooking, food with, you know, really trying to do it correctly. And she was just a brilliant chef and a wonderful person.
Her restaurant was in Brooklyn, wasn't it?
She did have Gage and Tullner in Brooklyn.
I never did go and eat there.
Well, see, when I was doing my apprenticeship in Charleston, she actually took over as a chef at the Middleton Inn in Charleston. So I met her. She was there every day. I waited, not when she was working there, but I had waited tables there in the daytime. So I was very familiar with the Middleton Inn and you know, I used to go out there all the time because the property is so beautiful, and it's one of the last standing plantations on the Ashley River. And you know, I would go out there, and she would be out there picking wild strawberries, and she was the real thing. I mean, I went to a symposium when we had Georgia Brown right before we opened. We didn't own it, excuse me. We opened the restaurant. I went to a symposium where she was talking at Middleton Inn, and it was just a fascinating person. It was a couple of days of real learning.
I have a tangential question for you. When you were waiting tables, that's just an interesting phrase.
Mm-hmm.
When you were waiting tables,
I started off working waiting tables.
What would you do when people made special requests and wanted to rearrange?
I wasn't
and
a
wanted
chef
to rearrange
then.
The food.
I wasn't a chef then, Tony. I was 16 years old. If somebody asked me to do something, I did whatever they wanted me to do. I started waiting tables at a Mennonite restaurant in Elkhart, Indiana, after school. And then the summertime, and then eventually, when I was in Charleston, I was very nice to people and did whatever they needed me to do.
So you figure we're going to have another segment about American food, and we'll get into a few things, and maybe what we think are iconic, a couple of iconic recipes or dishes. That's really kind of one of the things. Also, give us a ring and tell us what you think. Is there some sort of underground or unthought of or not often considered fancy American dish that you think is like the real backbone of our cooking? It's 410-662-8780. Or email us formanwolf@wipr.org. And we'll do a few more questions with Cindy Wolf, the waiter, when we come back on Foreman Wolf on Food and Wine on WIPR. We'll be right back.
is a young American.
Young American, young American. She was the young American all night.
But she was the young American.
Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
The aforementioned young Americans. Semi-young
Maybe
Americans.
Not.
Yeah. So we're talking about American food and your favorite iconic American dishes or your hero American chef.
And we're live, so we want to hear from you all.
So you can ring us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wypr.org. And I was teasing Cindy about waiter stories. I mean, I think the whole idea of American restaurants has changed enormously, right?
Oh, my goodness. It's amazing.
When we opened a restaurant that's probably the most casual, most modest that we have, my dad, who grew up in Southwest Baltimore, he had been to all of the places. And he has enjoyed all those restaurants. He always has. And we opened it, came and had a meal. He's leaving. It's like, I like this. It's like a normal restaurant.
Oh.
It's an American restaurant.
Yep. That's funny.
So, I mean, that...
Interesting.
That made me realize right away, I'm like, oh, what are the things that you have to have to be an American restaurant, right? I mean, is there something inherently democratic about it? Is you can't have... You got to have something for everybody. You can't be too self-important,
mm-hmm.
right?
Can't use another language.
And, we serve lots of burgers, all different kinds,
mm-hmm.
right? Sort of a one for everybody kind of a thing.
Yeah.
What else? I guess sandwiches, which is maybe not your bag entirely, but lots of sandwiches, salads.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it's approachable. I think that's probably what your dad meant.
Yeah,
it's completely understandable.
Well, it's approachable because we're here.
It's fun. It's easy. It's recognizable, and that makes you more comfortable. There's no challenge. If you go to a restaurant where there's another language or something like that, it suddenly becomes a little challenging, you know, unfamiliar. So things that are familiar are comforting. That's kind of fun.
Yeah. I mean, it's sometimes you go out for a meal and you want to sort of like leave town in an instant, you know. I spent a bunch of last night explaining the history of two dishes to a couple of tables in
fun.
One of our places, but... It's also nice when you don't even have to look at the menu to know what it is that you want to eat when you're coming into a place. Let's talk to Toby in Lauraville. Toby, go ahead.
Hey, Toby.
Hi. I live in Lauraville, and the Chameleon no longer exists, but all of us who used to eat there just long for the days when Jeff Smith was cooking, and it was Jeff and Brenda's restaurant, and it was just something very special.
That's awesome. What do you think was the most, what made it most special, and what dish do you think was the dish you missed the most?
Wow. I mean, there was so much that was good. But what we miss is more like a combination of you went in and there were great smells. The atmosphere was, it just transported you to someplace different from plain old Baltimore. You were in a magical place that you knew that no matter what you got, it was going to taste wonderful. Steak, oysters, anything, really, just anything that they made, the wilted lettuce salad. It was, I think they called it grilled lettuce. It was just outstanding.
Good.
That's great.
That's nice that you have that feeling about the restaurant. That I'm sure that means a tremendous amount to the people that owned it. That's awesome.
When you work in the business, you really aspire to have someone feel that way about the work that you mm-hmm. do, that's for sure.
Thanks, Toby.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Thank
have
you.
Have a good day.
So, and you can reach us 410-662-8780. And so how about you? What do you think are the dishes that are those things that we think of as not challenging somehow, but that can be excellent, transporting, satisfying, uniquely American?
Beef is one of the first things. I mean, you know, beef and shrimp and lobster, all the things that are indigenous.
I guess specifically beef what? You know?
Well, roasted beef is what we think of as being traditionally American. But, I mean, you know, having gone back and looked at all these menus, try and tie in my thought with what you just asked me is, you know, even from the 1850s and on into the really even to the 1950s, there were so many French influences on menus in the United States. And you would throw in things like shrimp cocktail, which obviously isn't French, raw oysters, raw clams, things like that, that were products that are indigenous to the United States or wherever these restaurants were. And then you see this change, which occurred in the 70s and into the 80s, where all of a sudden the menus were going from being heavily French to being heavily American. And that was
for being ourselves.
You know, it was really a huge change in cooking in the United States. And, and that being American means, again, kind of what you talked about at the beginning of the show, which is your own ethnic background and also, you know, things that we tend to think of as traditional products or traditional preparations. So, you know, now you're asking me, I think chicken soup was one of the things that I saw recurring on those menus,
but I never thought of that. How many different versions of chicken soup?
A million, you know? Right. And also how to a roasted chicken, the different cuts of beef, you know, often those menus were referencing different cuts and, you know, ribeyes and the New York strips, and all these things were so American, and everyone understands, you know, most people can read a menu and see New York strip and know what it is.
How about grilled cheese?
Sure. Tomato soup is another one. Grilled cheese, tomato soup, those things, what else is on your mind?
I mean, just there are so many things.
Mm-hmm. Lots of salads. You know, those are things that are sort of that foundation.
Salads mean like shrimp salad, like a shrimp salad
chicken
sandwich?
Chicken salad, all of those things. Yeah, yeah. All those mayonnaise-based salads are so American.
There are lots of variations, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's all straight out of Good Housekeeping from the 40s and 50s, right?
Right, exactly.
So let's go to Lindy in Pikesville.
Hi, Lindy.
Hi. I love your show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to pay homage to the late, great Pimlico Hotel, which was a Baltimore icon for so many years. And actually, now I'm very friendly with the owner's daughter and their family. And it was the place to go. I know you spent time here. I don't know how many years you were here when the Pimlico might or might not have been open, but consistently fabulous food, a huge menu, including a Chinese menu. And it was the place to go. And it was a place that when you went out on a prom date, you hope you were taken to the Pimlico.
That's neat.
That's awesome.
What were some of your favorite dishes?
Veal Oscar.
Yes.
They also had a whole pizza menu. But Veal Oscar... that was pretty much what I got every single time. And they had a great
that's awesome.
They had a great little bar next door, well, within the within the boundaries of the building.
Uh-huh.
The Bruce Westcott Trio used to play, and it was the place to go.
That's
and
amazing.
That's awesome, Lindy.
Yeah, when it went out, I want to
point out that in your describing an American restaurant, you pointed out that they had pizza, Chinese,
yeah.
and Veal Oscar on the same menu.
That's awesome.
So breadth and accessibility.
When one of the owners, Al Davis, we decided he wanted to have a Chinese menu added to his menu, and went to New York and, you know, got this great Chinese chef to come down, and nobody knew that Chinese chefs used woks and entirely different equipment. And the Chinese chef comes down and says, you know, where's my equipment? And he says, what do you mean? There's pots and pans and whatever you need. So they had to then, you know, create a kitchen for him so that he could produce, you know, more genuine food. It was fabulous.
That's
really
great.
Was.
That's great.
Great story.
Thank you, Lindy.
Thank you, Lindy.
For allowing me to share.
Thank you.
Let's talk to Angie in Northeast Baltimore. Angie, go ahead.
Hi, Angie.
Oh, hi. I wanted to talk about a cook. No, you won't know her name, but she influenced me greatly. I attended a school called Villa Regina Academy in the 60s, and it no longer exists. We were the last graduating class run by the School Sisters of Notre Dame. And if you wanted to become one of them, you went there to high school, and you lived there. And we all had jobs to do, very organized. And my best friend and I were two of the girls. There were three, actually, but the two, my best friend and I, we were assigned to help Sister Dabelia, the cook, was born after school, and
wow.
I learned a lot.
That's great.
She was very German, short in stature, but very kind and very loving. She loved her girls, And I learned things like tapping eggs when she had to cook 60 or, well, she had been on, she was probably 70 hard or softball eggs, whatever she was going to do. I guess it was a softball. But you had to tap them to make sure they weren't cracked. Mm-hmm. So I can tap eggs like a pro. She peels apples, which I already knew how to do. But my best friend, she did not. So she just really came up, looked at the peels, and my friend had to repeal her peels.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Germanic religion right there.
We had to go to this old part of the house underneath a porch, reach into the dark, and pull out a certain number of potatoes. Ooh. I don't know why these sacks of potatoes were thrown there. And I always expected to get a mouse. I dreaded that. I mean, you had to reach your, but we didn't have rubber gloves. Go get the potatoes. And you had to count. I was like holding my breath all the time. But, you know, I learned organization. Everything was so organized. I mean, if you were assigned to wash dishes afterwards, which the other girls weren't, we were more close one-on-one with sister, she would call the girl back from recreation. Did you put this pot lid away? Where did you put it? Why did you put it there? It doesn't go there. It goes here. Mm. And so I have a very small kitchen, but I'm very organized. I've got to have everything laid out. I've got to have everything put away. You know, my husband knows. I'll say,
is that one of the habits? Where's my meat fork?
Where did you put it?
So that's one of the habits that you learned from her, is that everything has its place and it's only going back there.
That's excellent discipline.
And don't waste. She was a great cook. I mean, one of her best dishes, I would say, was we look forward to a dessert, Apple Betty, but that came from the crumb jar. Nothing, you know, breadcrumbs, any crumbs from bread goods or baked goods went into the crumb jar, came out maybe a week or two later as Apple Betty.
Wow.
You know, everything was used.
That's great.
So she was great. She was very loving. She always talked about her girls. My girls, I love my girls. And she cooked for us, and I learned a lot. So I think of her as a little inspiration.
Absolutely. That's an incredible story, and how kind of you to share that with us. And that is, she was a great cook, because that is absolutely how you work in a kitchen and do it well, is to be extremely organized and clean. And the fact that you also mentioned that she loved you all so much, that's just incredible and great experience.
Thanks, Angie.
Nice chatting. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Angie.
Bye-bye. So I was just thinking, also late 80s, early 90s, Southwest Food blew up.
Oh, yeah.
You recall?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Mark Miller, Dean Fearing.
Yeah, I was just thinking of Mark Miller.
That cooking completely blew up.
You're right, yeah. That was a big trend.
I went to college in the early 80s in Texas, at TCU in Fort Worth, and there were Mexican restaurants, and there were American restaurants, which were essentially pretty much like steak and beer.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a few like beginnings of Tex-Mexy bars, but not really elaborate stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in Dallas, the town next door, the National Turtle Creek opened.
Oh, wow.
And that was a full-blown fancy,
You
know, Southwest American cuisine inspired.
Very highly respected place. For many years.
And then when I moved to D.C., Red Sage opened, which was Mark Miller's sort of Southwest palace.
Yeah, that was a cool restaurant.
Of sorts.
Beautiful interior.
And,
was hot. Man, that restaurant was hot when it opened. Mm.
But that was a huge movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that what's interesting is to look back in all the different, like, California cuisine got going in the 80s. The Southwestern stuff hit. Alfa Portale and a lot of the New York guys doing tall food. It's interesting. All of these things have built and built and built. You know, moving forward, and you see recycle on the product orientation, with people putting that front and center in the way that they talk about what they're doing. So that's why that seems like every 20 years someone's talking about how they're getting product directly from farms. I don't know where else you get things from, but it does seem like that's someone's leading sort of marketing term or whatever it might be. And it's an interesting thing to see all these things collect and coalesce.
I think right now is a huge trend is happening with plating. It has been for a number of years, but right now it's like every single thing I see almost everywhere on a food photograph on Instagram or wherever it is, it's this new plating style. where it's pieces and pieces and flowers and petals and, you know, a drip of sauce and dots and, you know, the plating style, it's like right now it's almost cemented and it's so different. It's really quite interesting.
It's super elaborate and it's definitely...
Some of it's extremely elaborate. Some of it's not.
It's definitely time consuming. And I always, you know me in a kitchen, I'm scared about something. Well, you're the same way. I'm scared about something being there too long. And the point of a hot dish is for it to be hot.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, or the temperature that it's meant to be.
Sure.
So by the time you finish fooling around, that was, you know, that whether that's American cooking or French cooking, Italian cooking, whatever it might be, everything degrades from the moment it...
Sure. You have to move fast.
Yeah.
Get the plate out. That's all there is to it. So, yeah, you can't handle it too much. Overhandled plating doesn't work.
So... We'll have a segment coming up where we'll do a new thing called Chef's Challenge, where I will give Cindy a long list of ingredients.
Some of them from
that may include bananas or Oreo cookies. So you can ring us back, talk about American food, your heroes, favorite dishes. If there's a restaurant that's passed away that was very special to you, that did American food, that had a special something that you want to talk to us about, 410-662-8780. Or email us foremanwolf@wipr.org. And look forward to that new crazy innovation called the Chef's Challenge on Foreman and Wolf on WIPR. She wants the young America. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. You can reach us. I know we have a few callers coming in right now. 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wipr.org. And we do have aforementioned emails. Why do restaurants, this is from David, why do restaurants in Baltimore never offer dishes with razor, no English, offer dishes with razor clams? I have had yummy razor clams in Venice, in Barcelona, and in New York City. Why not here? Baby razor clams are found in the bay and used for bait as crabs. But why not let them grow bigger so they can be cooked and eaten?
They're not always available. I've used razor clams. I know a couple of other chefs in town that do use razor clams because I've seen it on their menus. But they're not always available. I think that's what it is, probably more than anything.
Well, and I think maybe you, David, maybe you answered your own question on the ones found in the bay. It's crab meat is what people expect to come from the bay.
Right.
So, and from Willis and Waverly. A favorite emailer. What constitutes Mennonite cooking? That is all you.
Oh, okay. So my grandmother was Mennonite, but she had passed away before I was born. so I didn't get to experience it firsthand, obviously. But my father, I know, cherished the memories of things like sauerkraut and pork and pot pie and things like that. But honestly, I don't know that was necessarily Mennonite cooking, probably more Pennsylvania Dutch cooking from the York area, which is where my mom and dad are from. But I think you think of Mennonite cooking as being simple, down to earth and from the garden, quite frankly, because everything in their lives is meant to be very simple and humble and with respect to the earth. So I think it's probably just more, you know, potatoes and chicken soup.
Is it wrong
to
think of like ham loaf or chicken noodle soup?
I can't answer that question.
Hog maw?
Again, I think of that as Pennsylvania Dutch, so I don't know if it's necessarily traditionally Mennonite cooking or not. But all of those things, hog maw especially, were things that I grew up on.
Let's go to a couple of callers. Frank in Mount Washington. Frank, go ahead.
Hi, Frank.
Good morning. I love it when you guys are live.
We do, too.
Thanks.
It's fun.
Baltimore has always been such a great restaurant town, and I grew up in the 50s and 60s. I'm in my 60s now. And there's a whole list of restaurants from Hausner's to the Chesapeake to Danny's. They put out their sign, "The Whales Are In," to Thompson Siegert House, the House of Welch, Are we ever going to see restaurants that grow to be 50 years old and older, or has something changed in the business or our lifestyle or our association with food that the industry is going to churn faster than that and not have established restaurants for a long time?
That's an excellent question. One, this year, two restaurants in Baltimore just turned 50. Tio Pepe is one, and the Prime Rib is the other.
Actually,
the Prime Rib is 53 because it was born when I was born. But Tio Pepe is 50 this year. A lot of other ones. I think the thing that people don't realize once something gets, because we have restaurants that are 20 years plus or close to that right now, and it's dependent on people. It's not always not every generation wants their next generation to be in the business.
Right. Yes.
Or there's not particularly an interest. I mean, it's like any other business. And so, and sometimes you'll sell it to existing employees and you'll have something run in the same spirit. Oftentimes, maybe someone who thinks that they have their own particular new idea and they want to do it that way. Or maybe it's a family member that does it that way. You know, that there's a million human reasons why that doesn't always happen.
Yeah. You know, when Harbor Place first opened, there was a restaurant up near the Johns Hopkins University campus that had a chef, and he was really frustrated because no one was coming. And he said, you know, Harbor Place is going great guns. I went down there, and there's not a thing on the menu that you can't go from the freezer to the microwave to the table. And yet they are filling up. And so we have at least seen a transition from that. And as I said before, we're lucky to have had ethnic communities to give us authentic Italian and Greek and Asian cuisine. Just before I go, let me tell you, I used to work for WBAL as a reporter, and there was a culinary competition in Baltimore, and I was sent down to cover it. And so to have a little fun, I contrasted what was going on there with what was going on at a greasy spoon near the Baltimore City Jail called the Dog House, where a big hand-painted picture on top of the restaurant of a big hot dog.
I grew up here, I drove past it many times.
Right. Our meatloaf is made, not accumulated.
That's great. Well, Frank, thanks for the call.
Yes,
sir.
Love listening to your show.
Thank you, Frank. Yes, sir. Have a good Sunday.
Let's talk to Nancy in Parkton, who sounds like is mournful.
Nancy,
Nancy, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, so Billy Himmelrich, who was the founder of Stone Mill Bakery, had that wonderful weekend restaurant, Ecole, for a number of years in Green Spring Station, and every night they had chocolate creme brulee as a choice. And I can never find chocolate creme brulee anywhere anymore on a menu.
I guess that tells us...
I would also say there's a gap in the market for chocolate creme brulee. I have a chocolate creme brulee on my menu right now, so you can come see me.
I'll have to come.
That shouldn't be rare, I think it's sort of like the razor clam question. It's all a matter of timing. Sometimes, obviously we change our menu and our desserts frequently, and it's all a matter of catching it when it's there, I guess, sometimes too.
Nancy, have you tried making one?
Yeah, they're not hard to make. You should just make some.
You know, Billy showed me how to make it, but it was like stripping down the vanilla beans, and, it was a little bit more complicated than my personal skills could handle.
You can say you don't want to.
No, it's not that I don't.
I don't want to fix my car.
I don't feel like I'm competent enough.
You can do it. Honestly, I bet you can do it. You should try. You should find a good recipe and just try it. Please.
Okay, Well, thank you. And we missed that restaurant. It was wonderful.
I'm sure.
Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you, Nancy.
Okay. Take care.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
The creme brulee I miss, the best two creme brulees I ever had. One was
I
at
know where one
Citronelle.
Was. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it was Michelle Richard's. The bottom of the creme brulee was chocolate. The top of the creme brulee was vanilla. And it was very cool
to just take a spoon through there. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, God rest him.
Both layers.
And,
there's
another guy who came with the whole
big French
background.
Well, he started off as a pastry chef.
Huge French background, and then completely irreverent of it throughout most of his cooking
career.
Interesting.
Yeah. What's the other place?
The other was at a restaurant that was relatively short-lived that made a huge reputation for Rocco DeSpirito, who's been on TV a bunch since then. And that was Union Pacific.
Right.
It was right around the Gramercy Park.
The passion fruit creme brulee with pineapple
sorbet.
You've
heard me talk about it 8,000 times.
I serve
times,
that as
so,
well.
I know.
It's one of my favorite desserts I've ever had.
I told you,
in my
I came
life.
Back and said, this is great. Please rip this off.
Oh, yeah. I did. I did rip that off. And I don't often do that. But the other, I thought you were going to talk about, I forgot about Michel Richard's. I thought you were going to put that place up near Capitol Hill that we went. I think you and I went. Yeah, you and I went there. We sat outside, and you have the creme brulee, and they bake it like to order.
Yeah.
Oh, and it had raspberries on. Oh my gosh, it was like warm pudding.
I just didn't think it was that good.
Oh, Tony.
I just didn't. I was not impressed. All right, here's an email, Bobby in Baltimore.
Oh boy.
Historically, when I think of American food, I think of industrialized preservation, canned foods, dried foods, etc. Which, by the way, Bobby, you're right. I mean, that's a huge impact we've had on food here and around the world.
Absolutely.
What impact do you think that has had on our culinary history, and what do you make of our movement away from preserved product to fresh product?
Availability is what moved us away. You know, you had a lot of canned product during World War II prior to that, and frozen products sort of after World War II. And it all comes down to the fact that we have airplanes and trucks and so much convenience. We can get anything, anytime, anywhere, basically now. So, I mean, I think that's really one of the biggest things that has changed that.
Some of the movement away, I mean, obviously is driven by consciousness of the environment and also a desire to cook food more naturally with the seasons. And I'm you know, hugely on board with that.
Sure. It's the way I grew
I do
up.
Think that it's funny you mentioned preserving. I think a lot more preserving is being done, and I know that it is for us, even just in my house, the way that it was done 80, 100 years ago, where you get all the nice strawberries in at one time. So you're going to preserve a bunch of those strawberries in three different ways, or the tomatoes. I mean, there are four different kinds of tomato sauce in our house.
When you're taking wonderful, fresh, local product and preserving it to eat at another time, and that makes sense that would continue to happen, because that's extremely important, whereas canned food isn't that same nutritional value that you're talking about.
Yeah, we have an entire storage space dedicated to all of our preserved product in one of the restaurants. I mean, it's a crazy, it's a crazy thing. Let's take the call from, I apologize if I mispronounce it, Gina? In Baltimore?
Yes. Hi.
How are you?
Hi, Gina.
Hi. Good. Hi there. I'm thinking that I made a dessert or a dish for Christmas, which is called aspic, and no one knew what it was. And I'm just wondering, to me, it's so American to have leftovers in Jell-O molds. I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Well, when you say aspic, what do you mean? What did you make?
I just made a Jell-O with a lot of yummy berries in there and different vegetables.
Okay.
That kind of thing.
Okay.
Any kind of leftovers that you have that you just put in Jell-O.
Okay. So aspic.
Tony, are you familiar with that coming from Baltimore?
I'm familiar with my grandmother. One of her all-time favorite things to do at parties was to serve tomato aspic. And the tomato aspic would be served on salad greens with an additional dressing on the side. It could be blue cheese of some sort, or the ubiquitous at that time French dressing, which had that beautiful orange color.
Yeah.
So, but that's the one that I know.
So the idea behind aspic is that it's a French thing, and aspic is used for many different things. It's typically a stock thickened with a natural gelatin, and it's used to coat pâtés that have been sliced, and you want to put some sort of exotic, you know, or some sort of beautiful garnish on top of the pâté slice, and then you would put a layer of aspic on top to preserve it, to keep it from oxidizing, keep the vegetables or the garnish in place, or something as similar to what you're talking about with tomato aspic, which actually is a traditional French thing, or you could do a whole poached egg in aspic with truffle slices on top. So this is something, and even still now, if you go to a French shop, oftentimes
you can. That's not so American as I thought.
No, it's very French based.
Yeah. All of our food essentially comes one way or another. You know, is filtered through being in America, but it's via somewhere.
Yeah. So what you're talking about is American, no question. You're absolutely right. But it does have a basis from another cooking.
Well, thank you so much.
Sure.
Of course.
Thank you. I love nothing more than an existential question in an email. Chinese food, Mexican food, Indian food restaurants don't always serve authentic food to their origins. It's more like Chinese American, Mexican American, etc. Do these all constitute American cooking?
Oh. Huh.
I mean, I would say, of course.
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly like the Jell-O mold with with the aspic and all the business in there from
It's taking the original idea and changing it into something that is yours.
Something that that we're doing here uniquely here.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the way it's being done in India. It's the way Indian food is being done here for the audience that's here.
Okay. Good.
One of the quick email, Lawrence. Writes in, your discussion about American cuisine in earlier cookbooks makes me think. What do you think of the Maryland's Way cookbook? The beverage punch recipes are epic, not to mention the Maryland trivia sprinkled throughout.
I love those cookbooks. They're some of my favorite books that I've ever gotten.
The number of beverage and punch recipes and drink recipes in that book lets you know that Maryland may have a problem.
Are you saying that?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were reading that.
No, I'm saying that. I'm saying that. Thank you, Lawrence. One last quick call. Joe in Perry Hall.
Hi, Joe.
That's John.
Hey, John. How are you?
All right, John. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. And listen, my mother and father got married right after World War II, and she talks about her honeymoon in New York. And I think it was the 21 Club. I wouldn't swear to that. And she had it was called Essence of Tomato Soup. So it was a clear broth. And I've yet to find a recipe for that.
I cannot believe.
Are you familiar with
that? I can't believe you just said that because that I have the menu in this book that I was talking about earlier in the show from the 21 Club, and it does say that tomato soup, and it's a consommé. So it ends up being like a chicken stock that you clarify, but you add tomato product to it, so it takes on the tone of tomato. That should be what it is. So that's amazing that you just talked about that. I bet that was so delicious.
Thank you, Joe.
Quick,
we're running out of time. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, John.
Sorry about that. So, last question.
Uh-oh, yes.
The American dish that you do not want to admit that you eat.
Oh, I don't know. Oh, God, Tony, you go.
No?
I have to think about it. I don't know.
Mine's easy. You know it's a tuna salad sandwich.
Oh, I don't know. A BLT?
Yeah, you are a BLT.
I love BLTs.
Oh, my gosh.
All right.
Well, thanks for listening. That's all we've got time for today. If you want to email us, you can reach us, ForemanWolf@WIPR.org. If you want to listen to this episode or other podcasts, go to the WIPR website, WIPR.org, and look up the Foreman Wolf page, and there's a giant menu of goodies there for you. To follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media?
On Instagram as Chef Wolf, and on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf.
My Instagram is The Real Tony Foreman. Thanks so much for listening.
Happy Sunday.